Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 10th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, what happens when you brew the same beer with a 10, 30, and 60-minute mash? That's the question homebrewer Charles Hoffman asked, and he conducted an experiment to find out. Chris Colby and Kai Troister join us to examine his results. If you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores. And don't forget, if you got a BlackBerry, we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. I'm going to go straight to the meat of the matter this week. We talked for a good long time this week. Our current Brew Your Own magazine, Basic Brewing Radio Experiment, is pretty simple this time. On your next all-grain batch of beer, take an iodine starch test every 5 minutes and record your results. The data form is now up online at basicbrewing.com/experiment if you want to send that data in. The deadline is the last day of February, so you got some time. But this week's experiment from Charles Hoffman goes a bit further than just the starch test. Charles brewed 3 beers from start to finish to check out what happens with different mash times. Now, joining us to talk about the results are Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own, and Kai Troister, who you've heard on this show talking about his own extensive mash experiments. Well, I want to welcome to Basic Brewing Radio Charles Hoffman.
Hi.
Chris Colby.
Hey, James.
And Kai Troister.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Well, welcome, everybody. We've got 3 time zones covered tonight, and this is, I think this may be the first time that we've had this many people on Skype at once, so there may be some heavy editing later on as we reconnect over time. but we are here to talk about the experiment that Charles initiated, but what I want to do first is address an email from Graham in High Wycombe, England, who has some questions about the BYO BBR collaborative experiment number 7 that we launched last weekend, the one where we are testing a mash with a starch test every 5 minutes to see when the starch test indicates negative. In other words, when the starch test says that the mash has been converted. And Graham had some questions. He said, it strikes me that there are 1 or 2 snags with the experiment. One is that starch endpoint being reached does not indicate that the mash is complete. All it indicates is that the alpha amylase has done its job. The beta amylase still has to do its job, and it works behind the alpha amylase and much more slowly. You'll get a word of very low fermentability if you stop the mash at starch endpoint. Also, the reaction is extremely temperature sensitive. A small temperature difference can make a large difference in the time it takes to achieve the same level of extract, and hence the time it takes to reach starch endpoint. And then he gives some examples. That's just a snippet of Graham's email, but I think that is probably the high points that most question our methodology with this experiment. So I want to get your reaction, Chris, and your reaction, Kai. But let's start with you, Chris. Do you think that Graham has a point? Are we barking up the wrong tree with this experiment?
No, I don't think we're barking up the wrong tree. I think we're I think he's thinking of something different than what our experiment entails. We're looking for the endpoint indication as indicated by an iodine test. And, you know, he's talking about, you know, well, that doesn't mean the mash is complete. And that's true, I guess, if you have a separate definition of mash completion. But that's not what we're measuring. We're simply measuring the time it takes until an iodine test, you know, tests negative. And whether, you know, whether that means the mash is complete or whether you think you need more time, you know, that's one of the many things that a brewer has to determine. I mean, we know, you know, we know things like extra time, a longer mash rest at a given temperature is going to lead to, you know, especially early on, more extract as time goes on. You know, the second you mash in, you haven't pulled everything from the grains. We also know that fermentability goes up even at a given temperature as time goes on, just because you've given the enzymes more time to work on the mash. You know, if you pulled a mash on, you know, or if you pulled the wort off, say, before starch conversion, you know, and ran it all off, you would have, of course, a very unfermentable wort. But you know, if you waited up until the point of, you know, the endpoint indication by the starch test, you'd have, you know, a slightly more fermentable wort. And if you, you know, let it go on for a while, you know, eventually you're going to hit the wall where the enzymes have done all they can. But, you know, that may or may not be right at the endpoint indication that the start or the iodine test gives. You know, but that, to me, that doesn't change the fact that the iodine test is an indicator of, you know, certainly once that test goes negative, once you're not reading for starch, you know, it's an indication of the progress of the mash, and that's what we're looking for.
Yeah, I think it's a benchmark. And Graham brought up a couple of points further in his email, saying that different malts have different diastatic powers, and different mash temperatures can work more or less quickly as time goes on. But I think that's the beauty of expanding this experiment out to all the home brewers out there that I hope that will participate, is that we're going to get a large variety of different malts used and different mash times, or not times, but temperatures used. And so that maybe we can divine some trends among all that stuff. So Kai, what is your opinion of the iodine test as an indication of mash completeness?
I actually agree with a lot of points that Graham made with respect to using the iodine test to see if the mash is complete. The iodine test, what it can tell you is whether or not there are long dextrins or even long starches still present in the wort. And it's one requirement of a good brewhouse work that the wort that's coming out of the brewhouse is iodine negative, such that you don't have these large dextrins or starches. But it is an other requirement to have a wort of sufficient fermentability and also of sufficient extract content, so that you have reached a desirable efficiency. And I think Chris alluded to these points. So having a negative iodine is necessary for good beer quality, but it's not sufficient. And so that's what we have to keep in mind when we apply the iodine test and try to use it to possibly find the time at what or find the point at which we can stop mashing.
Now you go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry. It's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole puzzle in and of itself.
Yeah, and Kai added another dimension, or suggested another dimension to the experiment, and that is, if you own a refractometer and you're going through this test, when you take your sample for the starch test, also take a refractometer sample and record the gravity of your wort at that time. So we are now we've now got two dimensions that we're looking at, not just the single dimension of whether or not the starch test is positive. So if you go through a 60-minute mash, say, and at, say, you know, 30 or 40 minutes, whatever it is, the starch test becomes negative, then you continue recording the gravity every 5 minutes, then that can give you another indication of whether the starch test is the only test that determines when your mash stops, right?
Yeah, so what you can do with measuring the gravity of the word is you can actually measure how much of these starches that bear in the grain, how much of that extract potential, so to speak, has been realized in the mash. And in particular, if you would need to know the mash thickness for that and also the potential extract content of the grist. But generally, that potential extract content is around 80%. So based on that, you can actually calculate at each point in time then how many of these starches have you already converted and made soluble in the wort. And if you plot that, you either see that it goes slowly towards 100%, or it may even stop short of that, which means that you'd be unable to reach all these starches in the mash.
Well, I think that that's adding the option, if you have a refractometer, of taking gravity reading. I think that really adds a level of complexity to the test, don't you, Chris?
It also adds a nice, I think it'll add a nice bit of data there because, you know, for one thing, if we find that the starch test goes, you know, from positive to negative most of the time, right about the time that you hit, you know, like at least, you know, quite a bit of your, you know, potential extract, like you get, you know, if it goes negative right about the time that you've got almost all you're going to get out of your grain, that's one piece of information. But if the starch test turns negative, you know, and we see that with different malts that you still, you know, extract still climbs after time, that's a good indication that, having your mash extend beyond that point would be good. I mean, I've been to several commercial breweries where they do use the starch test as the indication for the time to mash out and start out, you know, recirculating and running off the wort. And, you know, obviously they have experience in their brew house and they know what that time does for their, you know, fermentability and all this. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, if people are going to use the iodine test and if they're going to use it as, you know, the sole benchmark for when to end a mash, it would be good to know, you know, how is extract being affected over the course of the mash with regards to that.
Yeah, interesting. Speaking of the starch test, Kai is working on his iodine starch test page on his website, kind of a how-to and I guess a why-to on your website, Kai, and I will post a link to that in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. If you have a question. So very interesting stuff. I'm hoping that a lot of people will take advantage of this opportunity to help us out with this experiment, because we're just asking you, you know, we're not even asking you to take time to ferment your batch all the way out. We're just asking you to give us data from the mash tun and we'll go from there. But this experiment that we're going to talk about tonight goes beyond what we're asking you to do for the collaborative experiment. And Charles, give us an idea of what started all of this.
Well, James, I some days I lead a really exciting life and other days it's pretty boring. And I spend a lot of time driving around Eastern Colorado and I spend a lot of time listening to Basic Brewing Radio. And one of the days I'm driving down the road and I heard Chris Colby was on and you guys were talking about conversions, and he said something more or less that conversion of starches happens very quickly in the mash. And I knew that was true because when I'd done my very first all grain ever, I was scared to death that I was going to come up with something not beer. And so I took iodine readings about every 5 minutes, and sure enough, I started seeing conversion pretty early, but that was a long time ago. And so I shot you a couple of tweets on Twitter and we emailed back and forth a couple of times, and shoot, it didn't take too long and we had ourselves an experiment.
Of course, it took me a long time to get on the ball and do my part, but you were very quick in doing what you did. I appreciate that. I appreciate you actually sent me some beers, and I'm actually sipping on three experimental beers right now. So while I'm doing that, why don't you tell me or tell us what your experiment was, and you know, sort of your protocol and your technique and all that.
Okay, well, the first part of the experiment, or the basis, I guess, of the experiment was to brew three identical batches and keep everything as close to the same as humanly possible, and to pull different mash times. And what I did was I did three complete 5-gallon batches, and I did my best to stop the conversion at 10 minutes, 30 minutes, and 60 minutes. And so I had three completely different batches of beer, even though the ingredients were exactly the same. Probably the first thing that I learned was 10-minute mash is not enough time to get your things in order for the rest of your brew day. The second thing that became really apparent is my efficiency, at least on my system, is really dependent on mash time. And I ended up with... Kai actually calculated the efficiency on these batches, and with the 10-minute mash, I only had 30% efficiency. The 30-minute mash, I had 38% efficiency, and on the 60-minute mash, I had 48% efficiency. And one of the things I did to minimize that numbers fluctuation was I didn't sparge these batches at all. I used a full mash tun. Did everything just like I was making 5 gallons of beer, but I just drained off what came off in the first runnings. That was all. And that way I wouldn't have, the question of, oh, did I add too much sparge water? Was my sparge water too hot or too cold? You know, I wanted to completely eliminate that variable.
And so you wound up with essentially three small batch, smaller than 5 gallons, three small batches of pretty good sized beers, gravity wise, and you just to let the people know out there, you didn't waste the second runnings. You made a beer with with the other second runnings, right?
I did. I saved all of them. It took me two different brew days to get the three batches done, and put them all into one fermenter, and I ended up with about 6.5 gallons of, I don't even know what you'd call it, a mild, I suppose.
So give us a bit of information on the recipe that we're looking at here, the grain bill and the hops and such.
Okay. Well, the grain bill started off with 10 pounds of 2-row, 1.5 pounds of Carrum Munich, and 1 pound of Crystal 120, and then I did 1/4 pound of chocolate malt and flaked oats.
And so you're the 10-minute batch. You wound up with 2.5 gallons going into the fermenter with an original gravity of 1063, and you finished out at, I'm looking at Kai's numbers here, 1012, and then the 30-minute, you had 2.5 gallons going into the fermenter at, I'm going to cheat here, I'm going to look at, I made notes.
Cheater.
I know.
1.08.
The 30-minute batch, you had an original gravity of 1080 with a final gravity of 1020. And then the 60-minute, you actually got 3 gallons instead of 2.5 with an original gravity of 1084. And I adjusted that, figuring gravity points. And if that would have been a 2.5-gallon batch, that would have been 1100, I believe, or maybe right. 1101. With a final gravity of 1020. So there's quite a bit of difference there in the amount of sugar that you got out of those beers between the 10, the 30, and the 60 minutes.
There is. There is a huge amount of difference in the sugars getting that we got out of there. One of the things that I think stands out, and we kind of talked about this before, was the amount of attenuation on the 10-minute batch, which I think is partially an explanation of, in my tasting notes, I said that the 10-minute batch was thin and cidery. Mm. And I think that's because, we started with a little bit lower of a specific gravity and it finished out so dry, and it was just, well, dry in comparison to the other two batches, and it just made for a beer that wasn't all that enjoyable.
Yeah, that's the thing that got me the most about your data was you got 81%. I'm using my numbers now. and help me out if I'm wrong here, Kai. 81% apparent attenuation on the 10-minute batch, but then 75% attenuation on the 30-minute, and then 76% attenuation on the 60 minutes. So that to me is counterintuitive, that the wort would be less fermentable as time went on. Can you shed some light on that, Kai?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive because, I mean, he was mashing at a fairly high temperature. It was 159 degrees Fahrenheit. And so why would you see a higher apparent attenuation for the shorter mash? And the reason is that in the beginning, when you dough in, both the alpha amylase and the beta amylase, they are fully active. They are as active as they can be because they are still all around. Now, as time goes on, the beta amylase will denature and the alpha amylase will be the more dominant producer of sugars or dextrins in that wort. But he didn't really let it get to this point. So after 10 minutes, he cut it off, and basically, so the head start that the beta amylase had was preserved. And as you go with longer mashing, yes, the beta amylase will be mostly denatured, and all that's kind of added to that pool of sugars, of water-soluble sugars, that pool is largely unfermentable sugars. So that's why you saw that kind of go down, the apparent attenuation. But also, well, as you keep going more on, keep going longer, there is still some residual beta amylase activity there. And to some extent, the alpha amylase can also generate fermentable sugar. But his increase of fermentability between the 30-minute and the 60-minute was just about 1%. Mm-hmm. So that means that most of your attenuation is actually created in the first 10 to 20 minutes of a mash, and the rest is just you're getting all the remaining extract out of the grain. In particular, that's true for single infusion mashing, where you use temperature to control the length of the beta amylase activity.
So he went from an original gravity of 1063 in the 10-minute, 1080 in the 30-minute, and then an adjusted original gravity of 1100 in the 60-minute. So, and you didn't do a starch test, right, Charles?
I did not.
So,
the appearance of that beer meshed at 10 minutes? Is it cloudy?
I'm holding it right here. It's a dark beer, so it's kind of hard to tell. It is. It's not. Well, again, it's kind of cloudy from what I can see. It is a very dark beer, so it's hard to tell.
I don't, without saying anything about the way it looks, to me, that beer tastes cloudy. It tastes like it tastes like a bottle of beer that got shook up and you were in a hurry and opened it and drank it.
That might actually be starch or long dextrins that that are still in this beer. And one problem actually with the long dextrins that I keep mentioning is that most of the time, what we call a starch haze, it's not really a starch haze. It's a haze of these large dextrins. And what happens is, as alcohol level increases in a solution, these long dextrins become less water soluble. So they precipitate and then show up as a what we call starch haze in beer. And that starch haze does not respond to findings like yeast or protein haze does.
Did you use Irish moss in this beer?
You know, James, I actually bought Whirlflock specifically for these three experiment batches, and it is still in my silverware drawer.
Well done.
That's just the way it goes. You know, one of the things that Kai was saying about the temperature on the 10-minute mash sort of makes a lot of sense to me, because I mash in a 10-gallon Rubbermaid cooler, and I usually don't even have temperature stabilized at 10 minutes. I mean, really, a 10-minute mash is you put your grain, I put my grain in the mash tun, I dumped the water in there, gave it a good hard stir, and it was about time to start draining it. I mean, it is so short, I really don't feel like, you know, I think we may have seen some numbers that would have been more consistent with a lower mash temperature, because I'm not really sure it got all the grain up to temperature in 10 minutes.
Interesting.
Can I ask a question? Once you, on the 10-minute mash and on the 30-minute mash, once you ran it off to the kettle, like how quickly did you bring it to a boil?
It happened pretty fast. I don't have a real high dig burner, but I boil on a turkey fryer, and but with the 3 gallons or so of wort that we had there, it probably was boiling in 5 minutes.
Okay, so because you know the mash, the enzymes are going to continue to work in the kettle. You know they don't know right. that they're outside of the mash tun and they should stop right. working. So I was just curious about that. One thing I would also just like to say is like James's data really didn't show the same thing. And there's, I don't know, I wouldn't want to read too much into one data point on something, because there's always, you know, even when you do things right in experiments, you sometimes get weird outliers. And, you know, that's an interesting result. And if it's, if it can be repeated sometime, then maybe we need to explain what's going on. But I don't know. Right now, I would say that it's kind of counterintuitive. It goes against what we think. And, you know, obviously it's a result. You can't just, you know, even in this day and age where people seem to love to do this, but you can't really just wish away data. But you also have to realize that sometimes that there are flukes and stuff. So you've got to, it's got to be a balance.
Well, I'm wondering if my mash ratio was thinner than Charles's, and that there were a couple of things. He had a lot more grain. He had a bigger container. He had a higher temperature. So these are kind of apples and oranges comparing these two as well. Let's start talking about me.
Let's talk about you, James.
My favorite subject. Well, inspired by your efforts, I did my own version of the experiment, but I went small batch, as I am wont to do. And what I did was I did 2 pounds of 2-row with 1 gallon of water, and that's a ratio of 2 quarts per pound, water to grain water to grain ratio, and I mashed at 154 degrees Fahrenheit, and I did brew in a bag, so I didn't have any issues with sparging or lautering or anything. So I did the 10-minute. In the pre-boil on the 10-minute was 1035. The original gravity going into the fermenter was 1066. And the final gravity was 1014. And that gave me an apparent attenuation on the 10-minute of 79%. And I did do an iodine test, and it was black. At 30 minutes, the pre-boil...
What was your base grain?
The 2-row.
American 2-row?
Yeah.
Okay.
Brees, I believe. 30 minutes, pre-boil, 1048. Original gravity, 1087. Final gravity, 1016. That gave me an apparent attenuation of 82%. And the iodine test was actually positive on the 30-minute mark. But what I did was I did the iodine test after I had taken the grain bag out and I had squeezed the bag. So this would be similar to a stirred result, you know, with our current collaborative experiment. And, I'm wondering if I would have gotten a negative result had I taken the test from the clear liquid on the top of the mash. I don't know. I guess I'm going to try both ways, stirred and unstirred, when I do the collaborative experiment. But that's neither here nor there.
Actually, where I like to take the iodine test, just to basically make sure that the word is iodine negative, I just take the iodine from the laudanum. So there are some cases when I have been using large amounts of Munich malts and also use decoctions, which both lower the enzymatic activity. And I found that the mash just didn't really want to fully convert. And when I then just took the iodine test off the spigot, then I got a negative iodine test. I mean, that's what we're looking for, that there is no starches going into the kettle. Technically, we want to have an iodine negative wort as we denature all this, the enzymes, which is as we heat it up to 170 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, with the 60-minute mash, what I did was I took a sample from the top of the mash before I took the bag out, and I took another sample afterwards, and both of those were negative. So that was an interesting result. With the 60-minute, the pre-boil gravity was 1051. Now, I got a little more wort going into the fermenter than the other two. The other two were fairly equal. The original gravity of the 60-minute was 1088. The final gravity was 1016. I think that there was either a difference between the boil intensity or the container that I was boiling in. But we can still get an indication of the fermentability because my apparent attenuation was 82%. So going off the pre-boil gravity is probably a better indication of the efficiency. So 10 minutes, 1035, 30 minutes, 1048, and 60 minutes, 1051. So again, the efficiency went up over the time period. And now with me, the interesting thing was that the apparent attenuation went up from 10 minutes to 30 minutes and stayed the same from 30 to 60. So figure that out, Kai.
Well, so about your efficiency, one thing that is good on your experiment is that you have a record of the mash thickness and you have the gravity that existed in that mash because you didn't sparge, you just ran that off into the kettle. And from that, we can calculate what I like to call the conversion efficiency. The efficiency with which you converted the starches in the malt. And for the 10-minute mash, I calculated about 50% conversion efficiency. So 50% of the starches got converted and converted into or in the mash. Then for the 30 minutes, I got about 70% conversion efficiency. And for 60 minutes, I got about 74% conversion efficiency. Now, what strikes me here is that even at 60 minutes, your mash did not convert all the starches that it could have converted. I know from my practical brewing, because I do mash a lot with that about that mash thickness, which is about 4 liters per kilogram in metric. I know that the maximum extract content you can have in the mash, that mash thickness, is about 16 Plato, and you're still short of that. And that is probably might be because of the coarseness of the of the milling of the grain. Maybe the grit pieces are too large, or maybe the pH is not right. But there is still a potential of about 26 more percent of starch to be gained in that mash. So maybe even mashing for 90 minutes could have boosted your conversion efficiency by 10 more percent, you know, for example.
Yeah.
Speaking about the apparent degree of fermentation, well, that does line up a little more what we kind of would expect, that there is a lot of change in the beginning when you still have the activity from the beta amylase, and then it just kind of drops off and kind of stays constant for the rest of the time, the mash time. But if you calculate that to actually the amount of actual fermentable sugars that were produced, which is the real degree of fermentation multiplied with the extra content that you extracted from the grain, you still see an increase there over that time. So even though your apparent degree of fermentation, so the apparent attenuation, starts to stagnate, you still keep producing fermentable sugars in that world, because obviously you'll keep producing more extract, so the fermentable sugars kind of have to keep up with the unfermentable ones to keep the degree of fermentation the same.
Well, it's interesting. I think I'm tasting, by the way, on a side note, I'm tasting Charles's beers, and the 10-minute beer, it tastes like a beer, but it's way out of balance. It's thin, and you know, the bitterness is way out of balance with the body of the beer and the, you know, the overall flavor of the beer. The 30-minute beer, I would drink. I think it's a tasty beer. The roastiness comes through. There's a good body to it. But the 60-minute beer is really a that's really a tasty beer. The alcohol is more present, but it's a more interesting and complex beer. So just in the case of this beer that Charles Hoffman brewed in Colorado on that day with that recipe, you know, a 60 versus a 30-minute and a 10-minute mash time, it would appear that a 60-minute mash time wins hands down. I mean, don't you think, Charles?
Well, you're about to make me blush and maybe even shed a little tear here, pride, because the only other two people that have tasted it other than you is my wife, who wrinkled up her nose and politely smiled and said, "That's good, honey," and my brother, who said it tasted like motor oil. So,
well, I'm a big fan of Tin Fitty, so...
me too. Yeah, to me, hands down, the 60-minute beer is a lot better. I would even like to take this recipe and maybe try a 90-minute mash with it, mm-hmm. and just see what becomes of that.
Yeah, it would also be a lot easier for me to do with my small batch to do a 90-minute version as well, just to see, you know, how much more sugar, you know, I can squeeze out of that process.
Right.
Well, actually, what you can do for instead of a 90-minute mash, you could also try what people call a mash out. In most cases, it's not really a mash out. It's a dextronization rest. It's an additional step in mashing where you raise the temperature to about 160 to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, and what that does, it enhances the gelatinization of more starches, and it also supercharges the alpha amylase to get more of the extract, and that's what I believe is the cause of the increased efficiency that some brewers see when they do that, the so-called mash out.
Yeah, in a perfect world, or in real life, what I would have done was I would have done a sparge with brew in a bag. You know, I usually reserve, say, a gallon or so of water in a separate kettle, heat that up to 170 degrees Fahrenheit, and then after taking the grain bag out of the kettle, the main kettle, I'd put it in the secondary kettle and stir it around, and, you know, do a sparge in that way. And I have been able to get better efficiencies in that regard. But, you know, this is just a very simple experiment, and I didn't want to introduce too many variables into the equation, so to speak.
No, that's a good idea.
That's where I was at too. I just, I even ordered all three batches of grain from the same place and had them, you know, had them mix the grains into one recipe so that there was no chance of my messing any of that up. I just can't get over the fact you call your show Basic Brewing Radio and we're talking about supercharging alpha amylase with Kai Troister. I mean, there's nothing basic about that.
Well, you know, once you know stuff, it becomes basic. That's...
The only hard question is one you don't know the answer to.
Maybe it's just my my goal here to make these things basic for brewers, because I feel the more you kind of know about brewing, the more relaxed of a brewer you'll be or become, because you just know when to pay attention to things and when you can just let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. The key is when to know when to worry.
Exactly.
That's right.
So Chris, what do you think? I mean, you've looked at the data, you've heard the testimony. What do you think?
I think we've got some interesting data here. I'm looking forward to our experiment too. I think one of the things that I mean this data set points out is that, you know, the mash is really, you know, on the one hand it's very simple. It's a really simple idea. You know, mix crushed malt with hot water and you get sugars out of it. On the other hand, you know, it's very complex. It, different temperatures, different mash thicknesses, different times, all feed into the final quality of your wort. And I mean, I know, like, on a couple looking at different ends of the scales on how commercial brewers approach the mashing. I mean, as I said earlier in the program, I do know of commercial breweries that use the starch test as an indicator of when to start recirculation and runoff. And that's another difference between them, a typical commercial setup and a typical homebrew setup, is they use a stirred mash, which is of course going to have an effect on efficiency and extract. But, you know, I know, you know, some brewers do that. It's they see the iodine test turn negative, and to them that's, you know, okay, it's time to start, you know, running off the wort. On the other hand, I know, like, for example, Bud Light, which, you know, is of course a beer we all
don't swear on my program.
Yeah. I promise I won't get into how they brew Zeman later. But Bud Light, to get the fermentability of their beer, at least from what I've heard, to the grapevine, is they have a several hour rest at 140 degrees Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
Low temperature, long rest that gives them, you know, probably not only extract, but certainly what they're looking for in a light beer is the fermentability. And, like, another weird, like, just another thing to think about, which is, you know, like, in brewing, like, brewing is, on the one hand, it's very simple. It's very, I was just actually brewing this weekend with a friend of mine, Ed, and we were talking about how sort of forgiving beer brewing is to the little things. But, you know, there's a lot of weird little, like, quirks that come up too. Like, I remember talking to the technical editor of Brew Your Own, Ashton Lewis, and he said that you know, one of the beers that they make at Springfield Brewing, which is the brewery that he's the master brewer at, is a Pilsner, and he had you know, they'd brewed it a bunch of times, and there was something that he didn't like about it. You know, I mean, he thought it was okay, but not great or whatever. And one day, for some reason, he tried a shorter mash on it, and he actually liked the beer better.
Hmm.
And his take on it was that, thinking back over the other beers, is he wondered if, you know, and again, this might have been peculiar to his water, time, mash thickness, blah, blah, blah. But he was wondering if, as the mash went on, he was pulling more tannins out of the grains, and that he, for him, on the Pilsner, a shorter mash resulted in a beer he liked a little better.
Hmm.
So,
and,
you know,
and that's certainly true. I think that's something that is true and known in brewing, that the longer you mash, you, the more you'll pull out the husks. There is even in German brewing something that's called short mash for fun, and I think in English it's called endosperm mashing. It's the idea that you actually separate husks and endosperm and mash in the endosperm, and then after a while, but before you start loudering, you add the husks to actually louder, just with the idea that this gives you a smoother beer because the husks are not exposed and leached out as long as for such a long time, but you can mash. But you can mash longer.
Hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, it just goes to show there's always a twist on everything. There's always the one next level. And, you know, I mean, I'm I'm a big fan of, you know, I know a fair amount of brewing science or whatever, but I also like to take into consideration practical experience. And I mean, I know this is going beyond the realm of this experiment, but that there really is something to brewing one beer that you like, or a couple beers that you like, and getting to know, you know, that beer, brewing it a couple times, doing different things, and not really so much, not ignoring the brewing science, but thinking more about, you know, I did this and this yielded a beer that tasted like this. And anyway, well, on that drunken note, I'll quit.
Well, it goes.
I've gotten to the point where I'm now pontificating. What do I think is blah 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 blah.
Well, one, you brought up a good point, Chris, and it's one of the things that I used to see a lot on the homebrew forums was everybody would come on and they would be panicking about this or that or something else. And probably the most valuable piece of advice you can give somebody is to just relax. It's going to make beer. Mm-hmm. And even with a 10-minute mash, and it may not be the best beer I've ever brewed, but I made beer in 10 minutes with a mash. I made beer.
Yeah, it's not the best, but, you know, it's fairly drinkable and it's not poison. So
it's probably better than my first batch of beer, although I don't really remember.
High praise indeed. It's not poison.
Well, on that note.
Well, actually, let me try to add some more information that I kind of know about length of mashing. Having read some of the German literature, is that unfortunately there's not a one size fits all, and like with many things in brewing, there's a lot of things that kind of work against each other. Like as Chris said, you want to mash shorter to limit the tannin extraction from the husks. But then there are other things that make you want to mash longer. Obviously, you want to have, for Pilsner, you want to have a crisper beer. You want to have a lot of fermentability. And one thing also found in the literature is that supposedly a rest around 160 degree Fahrenheit held for 30 to 60 minutes enhances mouthfeel and head retention because there's some glycoproteins that go into solution there. I've also read comments that a short mashed beer supposedly tastes kind of greener, not as refined as a beer that has been mashed over a longer time. So I mean, this kind of gets almost into the same corner as like the decoction mashing goes, where it's really difficult to tell these differences. And there's a lot of brewers who have also different opinions and think that this is better because obviously they read it there and they trust this source. So yes, there's a lot of that's to be said, but at the end it's like, well, try different things. Like don't think that because everybody mashes for 60 minutes, you have to mash for 60 minutes. You can try 30 minutes or you can try 90 minutes and see what is better in your brewing, and actually it may change from beer to beer that you brew.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the more tools we have in our toolkit and the more we know what those tools do, I think the better brewers we are, I hope.
Right. And one thing that brewers oftentimes point to when they try to argue that, well, you can't just mash for, let's say, 15 to 20 minutes. They like to point to the conversion time given in the malt analysis sheets. And I want to give some perspective on that. Those conversion times are actually determined, like, if the maltster uses what's called the Congress mash to determine these conversion times, then the mash sample is actually doughed in at about 45 degrees Celsius, which is about 110 degrees Fahrenheit, it's held there for 30 minutes, and then it's ramped up to about 70 degrees Celsius or 160 degrees Fahrenheit over 35 minutes. And not until it reaches the 70 degrees Celsius does the clock start for measuring conversion time. So basically, you have this grist that is optimal form for mashing because it has been pulverized for this mash, but it has already been mashing for almost an hour until they actually start the clock to measure conversion time. Now, it has not been at 70 degrees Celsius for about an hour, but it has been at lower rests, which do give it kind of a head start. So, and after that, well, once it reaches these 70 degrees Celsius, then they start the clock for conversion, and after, say, 10 to 15 minutes, it fully converts. Well, that doesn't mean that if you dough in this malt at 154 degrees Fahrenheit, that after 15 minutes, it will be converted. For one, your grist is not as pulverized as the Congress mash grist is, and you are at a lower temperature, and you'll probably mash at a much thicker mash than the Congress mash, which is mashed at about 8 liter per kilogram. No, actually, which is mashed at about 6 liter per kilogram, which is 3 quarts per pound. So this is difficult to compare this number that you see in the malt analysis sheet and actually apply that to your brewing.
That's what we in the journalism profession call a buried lead. Mayhaps I may put that at the beginning of the of the episode. Now that's useful. That's useful information. That the stuff on the data sheet is not necessarily does not necessarily apply to your practical brew day.
It's good for comparing malts between each, like to compare different malts with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't really say that. Okay, that means I only need to mash this for 15 minutes because it says that.
Well, excellent.
Yes. It's good information. You just need to know what it means, essentially.
Right. Well, guys, I think we're about out of time. Now, that doesn't mean we can't continue to talk and drink a couple of beers after I hit stop. But at this point, I think we'll leave the listeners behind. I certainly appreciate, Charles, I appreciate the time and the energy and the beers. I think this has been an awesome experiment. And Chris and Kai, I appreciate you guys' information and insight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, Charles, for doing that experiment. And, you know, thanks, Kai, for joining us.
Absolutely.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks again to Charles, Chris, and Kai for getting together. Charles did a lot of work, and I very much appreciate his time and talents, and the 30 and 60-minute beers were indeed tasty. And by the way, last night I sampled a Doppelbock that Kai had sent me a great while back, and it was simply amazing. Very malty and tasty and just beautiful. Kai, he knows what he's talking about. And just so Chris isn't left out, I've also had his beers on a few occasions. And, you know, he's no slouch in the brew house either. You know, I'm a lucky guy to have sampled as much good homebrew as I have. Don't forget, there is a link to Kai's website on how to do a proper starch test. And be sure to check that out for helping us out with our current experiment, our collaborative experiment. Until then, I'm off to shovel some snow. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, our Stepping into All Grain DVD, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits as well, along with our 2011 Brewers Logbooks. We still got plenty of those, but they're a limited edition. You know, once they're gone, they're gone. We've got combo deals on our site to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in our store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online at our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto, and Swiss Sport Adult Adventurer Mummy Ultra Compactable Sleeping Bag. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget that you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through our associate links on basicbrewing.com as well. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.